We all know the truth. More connects us than separates us. But in times of crisis, the wise build bridges, while the foolish build barriers.
You raise walls, I destroy them. Let's see who prevails.
Just because something works doesn't mean that it cannot be improved.
I say we take off and nuke the entire site from orbit.
It's the only way to be sure.
Allow my sword to join you in the fight against evil.
The world needs us to chase dreams.
We have to dedicate ourselves each and every single day to this fight because I can't do it alone.
You, the people, have the power. The power to create machines. The power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful. To make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us all unite.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show. I'm Jen, and today on Signal Boost, we have the fabulous writer of games and short fiction, Aaron Roberts. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Hi.
So, my first question is always, tell us about yourself and your work.
All right. That should be super easy, but of course is not, because I do a bunch of different things. Just for fun and to, I guess, keep myself entertained. So I think I'm mostly known as a writer of short fiction. I've written a few short stories, mostly on the dark side of things, or so other people tell me. But I've also written some essays. I've done some reviews. And as I think you alluded to in the introduction, I've done some game writing, interactive fiction, and audio fiction. So oh, and I think I've also edited a guest edited an issue of Strange Horizons, and used to be a slush reader. So basically, if it's out there and it involves storytelling, I've probably dipped a toe in the water at one point or another.
Toe dipping is always good, although it sounds like it's a little bit more than toe dipping, and this is a big thing for you. Like, you do this, you get published in this, and that's awesome.
It's crazy is what it is, because in reality, you know, I saw a question on Twitter the other day where people are like, when did you first like take writing seriously? And people were like, at 8, in the womb, I had a quill, you know, whatever. And I was like, 4 years ago. So I, you know, have always liked to tell stories at parties, and all my journal or like all my notebooks in school are covered in, well, drawings of kudzu and also like poetry and playwriting and things like that. But I really didn't think I would ever like try to get published or write like for other people to read it until about like 4 or 5 years ago. So it's crazy to me that I've actually managed to like get published and really like kind of, it's like I decided to take something seriously and it actually worked. So that's always fun.
So you mentioned kudzu, which is one of my favorite invasive plants.
Is there a list of invasive plants?
Probably somewhere. But that reminded me, just because kudzu reminds me of the South and decay and all of those things. And I just read Snake Season. So that was a story. You mentioned dark. That was definitely dark, which is appropriate considering it was, you know, published in the dark. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that? And more generally, how do you see some of the themes that are in that story, and if they play into what you've explored in other stories? Is there something that kind of unites what you write?
I think there is, and it's funny that that is a dark story, you know, as you said appropriately. Though, of course, I tend to find that other people find my work way darker and creepier than I do. Like, so if there was a scale from 1 to 10, I'd be like, that's a 7. And other people are like, that's a 12. So, you know, I don't know what that says about my internal state, but there you go. All my stories, I would say, are really about people. I love to get really deep into people's heads and see what they're thinking and their journey as they navigate through a pretty screwed up landscape or world around them. So a lot of times I like to say that society is the true antagonist in every one of my stories. And probably Snake Season is the one that's the least that way in some ways. But I love to try to create a feeling of a stagnant, oppressive world around the protagonist, and then figure out what fun and interesting ways they will try to deal with that isolation or stagnation or oppression. So it's really like, it's like they say, like, man versus nature or person versus person. And mine is really a lot of times person versus society, or person versus what society has imposed upon them.
That definitely ties together all the stories that you had published in 2018, I have to say. Although you mentioned that in some ways the snake season is the least about society, as a mother, I can see how much society still plays into the monster that the mother of that story creates for herself repeatedly.
Yeah, because I think for the motherhood is kind of, like you're saying, is the monster. But also, she doesn't think of any other role for herself. She's a woman who's a mother who seems very trapped and very isolated and feels very isolated, but never kind of thinks outside of that box. And part of that is because that's the role that her society around her has given her. It's less explicit in that piece, but for me, it feels like there's nowhere else she can go. There's nothing else she can do but be a mother. And so even though her version of motherhood is not a great one, it's the only role that she knows for herself. And so figuring out how to live within it is really the struggle that she has through this whole story.
Absolutely. It was a really compelling story for me. As we mentioned, you also do game design, and the one that came out in 2018, which I found really fascinating because it coincidentally connects with your story, The Sour Milk Girls, is Thanks for the Memories. Could you tell us about how telling stories via games versus writing short stories? Like, what do you think the strengths are, one opposed to the other? Is there something that game narrative lets you do better, or short fiction do better? And tell us a little bit about Thanks for the Memories.
So as you mentioned, Thanks for the Memories is a story set in the same universe as my story that was in Clark's World in early 2018, Sour Milk Girls, which is a world where memory is a commodity, and one that I'm slightly obsessed with. I probably will eventually write a novel in this same world, because it really interests me when we commodify memory, basically who gets screwed. A lot of my stories are about who gets screwed in any particular social system. Who's the outsider? Who's the person who's struggling? And how can they find their way in a world that really doesn't value them? This is completely off from your question, but I find a lot of times when I write, there's a huge pull towards writing in like an evil antagonist that is just like doing it behind the scenes, a person that wants to destroy your protagonist, your main character. But I find it way more interesting if it's just that the world in general kind of just doesn't care about your main character and makes their life difficult, but not in a directed way, in just the way that the world around you, the world can treat marginalized people. And I don't know if that's from being a Black woman. That's something that appeals to me, is feeling like there's society just doesn't care, and you still have to carry on, and you still have to do your own thing and react either well or poorly, in the case of many of my characters, to realizing that the world kind of doesn't care about you and is that the deck is stacked against you. But to answer your question, the difference between the two is it's really, to me, about control. So in a short story, like, you're really trying to control the reader experience. You can't. It's a lie. But you'd like to think that you can. You know, you pick your words so that it creates a certain rhythm and a feel. And I'm very much into voice, so you really want to capture the voice of the main character so that it almost feels like the main character is whispering a story in the ear of the reader. But in a game, it's nonlinear. So you have to cede a lot of that control. It's like you're just creating the elements of a story and letting the reader pick their own way through it. And the main thing you have to make sure is that no matter which elements they pick and which order they decide to experience your story, that it's still a story worth experiencing. So it's a very different approach, but it's really fun. And I think Thanks for the Memories, which is a story about a woman who has lost all of her memories and is trying to basically figure out who she is and who she can trust and what's going on by replaying and re-experiencing her own memories. You know, there's no way you can get to all the memories in the story at once. And I tried to write that story as a short story, and it was very odd and it didn't quite work. But by ceding that control and letting the player actually have that experience of not knowing and then gaining knowledge, it finally worked. The form and the story I was trying to tell were able to line up exactly.
That's really interesting. I only had enough time to go through once. And of course, I ended up with the selling my memory of that experience. And I was like, oh, sad face. But I hit a point where I was like, oh my God, I don't know who to trust. I'm so overwhelmed. And I'm like, you know what? Screw it. I'm selling this memory and hopefully that helps me out the next time I wake up. And it was fun to go through that. But you use that same company as the Sour Milk Girls, though both are partially about experiencing memories and losing memories and things like that. So I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit more about Sour Milk Girls and just where the sort of concept of MemCore came from, because it really reminds me of both The Sleep Dealer and Strange Days, except much more catastrophic.
I think so. I am fascinated with memory in general. And one thing, random fact to know about me, is that I don't have a visual memory. Like, I can't visualize things like as a person. And so it's one of the reasons that I've always loved to tell stories, because my memory is just composed of stories and not of images. And it means that it's very difficult for me to remember things because I can't just call up, oh, the image of that time we went to that place. And so I think because of that, memory has always been fascinating to me. And I think that creating this universe where there's a company that can let you buy, sell, trade, anything you could do with anything else, like imagine the social media of memory, was just something that I think I came up with one day and was like, oh my gosh, I need to write 1,000 stories about this because there are so many ways that this could be used and, more importantly, abused. So in Thanks for the Memories, it really explores somebody who has chosen to kind of sell their own memories, lose their own memories for their own, to deal with their own issues. Where Sour Milk Girls is about orphans whose memories have been forcibly taken from them as a sort of therapy, sort of bad therapy. Think of like the
very
things
much.
That when shock therapy was big, and like, that was a great idea. Wait, no, maybe it wasn't. So this is, they are a bunch of orphans, and so they wipe all their memories so that they'll all theoretically be on an even playing field and have no personality issues. And of course, it does not work out that way. So it follows sort of this group of girls living in the orphanage as they deal with the arrival of a new girl who does have some memories, and trying to figure out how they deal with that difference. And so I just thought it was really interesting to kind of deal with what happens when other people get to decide what's important. And then also exploring kind of the memories that they do have and who's wanted and who's not wanted. There's a colorism issue, a race issue in that story, in that the main character Ghost is Black. And that's one of the reasons that she's not really adoptable in the way that a lot of the other girls are. And the way that she processes that is also a part of the story.
Absolutely. And now I'm sort of thinking about, as you mentioned earlier, dealing with how marginalized people are seen and heard and how their stories are told and written and experienced, how memory and how the narrative of memory can be controlled is a useful way to explore the experience of marginalization.
Yeah, and I think for me, it also takes marginalization to the next level, because I think, I don't want to say within Black culture, but within the Black culture I have experienced, there's a sense that, you know, outsiders may be beating us down, but we have ourselves and we have, you know, our own internal strength. And that includes your memory and your sense of self. If people can invade your memory, if people can play with your own sense of self, then what do you have left? Where is your strength coming from? If the marginalization is not just from the outside in, but from the inside as well. And so that's something that's very kind of, that actually does scare me. Many of the things I write that scare other people don't scare me, but that scares me. The idea that you have nothing left that's truly you. And so then you don't understand yourself, and it's hard to understand how to fight against an unjust world.
That's really fascinating, and I'm glad that I got to go through and read those stories today, because excellent work, I have to say. Why don't you let our listeners know where they can find you and where they can find your work so that they can go enjoy everything too?
Great. So the best place to find me is on Twitter at Nirelle. It's N-I-R-E-L-E, or as I like to tell people, L Aaron backwards.
Oh.
Not done on purpose, but it's a good thing. It's a good way to remember. Accidental. And I have a website, writingwonder.com. And I won't say that I post frequently, but I do post story notes for every story that I've written. So if you want more understanding of sort of how I came up with these ideas and what I think I'm exploring, that's always a good place to see it. And then in terms of my work, I had a bunch of things out in 2018, sort of. So I had Sour Mill Girls in Clark's World in January, Snake Season in the Dark in April, The Grace of Cestus 5, which is in the September-October Asimovs in 2018, and then Thanks for the Memories, as we've been talking about, the interactive piece was in the December 2018 Sub-Q magazine. So that's just, there are a few other things I've done, but those are, 2018 was my big year, so.
That's awesome. So, again, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It was really interesting talking to you, and I'm just so glad that I was like, Aaron, come on the show.
Me too.
So listeners, make sure that you go check out Aaron's work. She's got a nice blog post that's all of her eligible works from 2018 that has all the links, which will be in the show notes. And yes, go read them. Warning though, Snake Season is dark. And with that, talk to you later.
Welcome to Skip Me Panty Show Signal Boost. Today on Signal Boost, we have Sarah Chorn. Say hello, Sarah.
Hello.
And Sarah Chorn is here to tell us about her book, which should be out by the time this episode comes out, Serafina's Lament. So, Sarah, why don't you give us the elevator pitch for your book?
Serafina's Lament tells the story about a dying world and a group of escaped slaves and other sundry characters who are, in essence, trying to save the soul of their nation. There's a dictator who rises up and they don't like him and they want to overthrow him, but things happen and the problem becomes larger than anyone foresees. And things change. I don't know. I don't know how to summarize it. I wrote it. So to me, it's like all intricate and dense and it's just hard. So essentially, things suck and a bunch of people are trying to change it, the suckage. And then it sucks a little bit more until the end, I guess. It's pretty dark. I don't know.
So would you say this is grimdark?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't write it with that intention, but yeah, I think it's pretty grimdark.
I mean, I'm going to ignore the elephant in the room for the moment until later because I want to talk to you about that. But let's talk about the fantasy side of this novel. And you, like me, are a big reader and a big reviewer, big time bookworm blues. So what fantasy novels, conscious or not, do you think were percolating in the back of your mind when you sat down to write this story?
Oh, God. That's a tricky one. I don't really know. Like, Mark Lawrence has always kind of been a huge influence to me because he was the first really dark fantasy author who paired these just horribly grim fantasy landscapes and plot lines with just the most gorgeous writing ever. And I've always thought that that was the coolest combination of elements there, just having this super dark story mixed with this just gorgeous prose. And so I guess a lot of my writing style itself was trying to sort of emulate that kind of thing. I have an incredibly dark book. Like, Michael Sullivan read it and he just wrote me in an email and said that Serafina's Lament makes the warded man look like a Disney princess tale. So he thought it was super dark. And So for me, it was a lot of that. It was a lot of merging this hugely dark story with just as pretty of writing as I possibly could.
So novels like Prince of Thorns influenced you to take up and tell this story in your own way. That sort of marriage of literary fiction and dark fantasy.
Yes. Yes. Very much so.
Cool. So who's our protagonist?
We have a few of them, and it's been kind of interesting with early reviews because I have a handful of point of view characters, and every single reviewer has come back to me telling me that they think the protagonist is someone different. I have not got the same answer twice. So I think it's going to depend on who you are and what you get out of the book as to who you think the protagonist is. For me, I think they all are in their own ways. The character that tends to appeal to people the most is Taub, who kind of turns into the Bone Lord who eats people. He was in the first chapter that's up on Fantasy Faction. But, you know, there's other people. One reviewer likes my character Vadin, and she thought he was the guy. And for me, Serafina is the one who speaks to me the most because she's disabled, and I poured a whole lot of my health issues into her as a character, into her evolution, and into her story arc. So for me, it's Serafina. But everyone else gets something different out of the book, and because of that, I think different characters will appeal to everybody.
And Serafina is on the name of the book, after all, so while you wrote it with Serafina in mind as the main character, it sounds like you have a suite of characters there that different people can grab onto, threads inside of your fantasy world and identify with.
Yeah, and they're all kind of messed up in their own ways. Serafina's an escaped slave who's disabled and she's been very abused, and she's kind of messed up. And that kind of was very personal to me. Her twin brother, Nurian, is eaten alive by survivor's guilt the whole time. And then there's Vadin and Ayad, Ayad's essentially Stalin in this world. And there's just all these different characters. It just depends on who appeals to you, I think, and their personal story.
So why tell the story that way rather than a single point of view? Why the suite of point of views? Why did you choose to tackle the story that way?
Because sometimes I think events are too big to be told with one person, and I'm always kind of a big sucker for the antagonists that you can relate to, and I think all of my characters are incredibly morally gray. And I think that's important because what one man's evil is another man's hero, you know? So Ayad's kind of a dick, but he's also, to a lot of people, saving the country. And that was very much the case with Stalin, too. He killed millions of people. He was a horrible person. But you still have people today who are all like, go Stalin. We need someone like him again. I mean, you've got Putin who just said that a few years ago. So you have this in our own history. And I thought it was very important to bring a situation that was as big as the one that I was trying to portray alive in as many different points of view as possible to show how it impacts different people. And I tried to be very careful with that in a lot of ways, especially I have interludes throughout the book too that touch on lives of people that aren't even related to my cast and characters. So I just tried to take a situation and I tried to show it as being, I don't know, as diverse as I could from as many points of view, because nobody experiences the same thing the same way.
Well, yeah, so you've alluded and you've kind of touched at it gently, but let's dive into that real life history that you're pouring into this book. So this is based on real life events in the Ukraine in the 1920s and 1930s, is that correct?
Yes. So I'm pretty sure I'm probably saying this wrong, but I've heard it said Holodomor. So there's the Holodomor that was in 1932 and 1933 in Ukraine. And what happened was Stalin basically passed a whole bunch of laws and decrees for the Ukrainian people that sent them onto collective farms, and then it took a whole bunch of people off of collective farms and sent them into factories, and so the land was both over and underworked at the same time, and it was uprooting this traditional way of life. And then he took all the kulaks, who are the landowners, and he sent them off to labor camps, off to gulags. And he had these secret police and soldiers go from house to house and get all of the grain, because not enough grain was growing, and turn it over to the state. And they'd go through with these long poker sticks, and they'd have people sit in trees and looking if there was a can, if there was smoke coming out of someone's chimney, then it meant that they hadn't turned all their food over to the state. And so there were just people who were starving, and they had roaming bands of cannibals, and people would eat their children, and then they'd tell their children, if they survived, eat me if I die first. And it was just this horrible, bleak time. So many people died. Nobody even knows how many died. Estimates have gone as far up as 10 million. And records weren't released until the late 1980s and early 1990s. And there's still not many people know about this event. But yeah, that's what my book is historically based on, is the Holodomor. And I have the character Taub, who's basically the embodiment of the Holodomor. He's basically the marching plague of starvation. And then I have another character, Mouse, who kind of represents the loss of hope and the loss of your soul when these situations get just so big. And I have interludes peppered throughout the book. I think I have four or five of them that are actual, I changed them to fit my world and my story, but they're based on eyewitness accounts of the Holodomor that I've read in my research. And they were pretty hard for me to write, and I've had several people say, oh, maybe you should take them out of the book. But for me, putting them in was very much a homage to the people who had to survive this horrific event and have so many stories that are just left untold because of all of these hidden histories and just atrocities that have passed. So it's very largely based on that.
So how did you come across the Holodomor in the first place?
I went to the library. So I have this weird thing when I feel like I'm going to write a book, I kind of get this feeling in my brain that I have something up there. It's in my hind brain and it's percolating and I don't know what it is yet. And so when that happens, I go to the library and I basically check out my entire nonfiction section. And then I take it home and I just read a ton of books, historical nonfiction books, until I find the one that triggers whatever the hell it is in my hind brain and lets it loose. And in this case, the book that did that was Bloodlands. And it's written by an author called Timothy Snyder, and it addresses the Holodomor. It's called Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. And it goes through World War II as well. But I remember reading that and thinking, my God, this is it. And I have the series title, it's going to be a trilogy, is The Bloodlands. And a lot of is because of that book, because that's the book that triggered this whole thing.
And you just kept exploring and learning more about this, as you said, not very well-known time. I mean, part of my mother's family was from the Ukraine. Other part was from Poland. They never talked about this, and they would have left about this time, as far as I could figure from the histories. They never talked about this sort of history. So it's like it's kind of like a shock and a slap to the face that this sort of inhumanity would happen.
Yeah, they call it the Silent Holocaust. And it really, really was. And nobody knows about it. I tell people in the West that this book is based on the Holodomor, and everyone looks at me like, what are you talking about? Nobody knows. And there were so many tragic deaths that happened. It was just such this huge thing. So many people died. It got to the point where people were so desperate in villages that they would volunteer to be sent to gulags, because at least in a gulag, you got to eat once a day. And toward the end of it, there were more Ukrainians alive in gulags than there were in a lot of these villages. So it was just this horrible, tragic event. And then at the end of 1933, Stalin looked at Ukraine and sent a bunch of Russians there to go and settle where all the people had died. So, you know, he kind of switched the population. He got rid of a lot of the culture. He did all these things, and we just don't know. And I just thought that was tragic and incredibly compelling. So down the rabbit hole I went.
And given the Russian-speaking populations of the Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea and stuff, this event 90 years ago is still being affecting us today.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. And I think I've read so much Russian history. I've come to the conclusion that we can't understand Russia unless we understand its history. And we just don't over here. There's so much of it that we just don't know. So anyway, that's why it was based on the Holodomor.
Very, very cool. So you're thinking this is going to be a trilogy, and so you're going to structure the other books similarly to this? Follow a suite of characters, throw in interludes, and or are you going to be more experimental in your writing? And how closely are you going to align yourself to the events of the Holodomor inside your fictional world?
I think book two is pretty much going to take off from it. I'm still kind of gestating it. I've started writing it a little bit, but the end of book one kind of leaves pretty much history behind, I guess you can say. It's very much starting fresh. I kind of have to do a whole new suite of world building. And so I'm kind of establishing new religions and new societies and new boundaries and all this stuff for book two. And it's super intricate. Like, I don't know why I did this to myself. But on the other hand, I think it's pretty cool. So we'll see how it turns out. But yeah, book two pretty much takes off from it pretty a lot. I think book two is going to be a lot of a creation myth. And I've been studying a lot of creation myths from around the world to kind of get ideas for it, I guess. So I don't know. It'll probably be roughly the same format stylistically.
So the events in book one are based and inspired by Holodomor, but and you're doing a lot of more late world building in book two. So in book one, what sort of world building have you done already? What sort of cultures and ideas have you taken from to build the underpinnings of culture and society that we see undergoing this tragic event?
I had to study a whole lot of Stalinism. I have read probably over 4,000 pages on Stalin to write this book. I mean, I have read so much on Stalin. I feel like I know the guy better than I know myself. Like, I know he almost never smoked his pipe. It was just a prop. I know that he had super bad cavities in his molars. I mean, I know stuff about Stalin I just never imagined. So, but I had to get his government system right. I really wanted to get a lot of the little details about Stalinist communism correct for this book, and that's a lot of what it's based on. I have a character, his name's Ayad. He is essentially my Stalin, though I kind of humanized him a bit more than that. And I call it collectivism, not communism, but there's communal farming, which is an issue that's touched throughout the book. There's slavery, which wasn't really in communism, but I added it because I had to for Serafina's plot arc. But most of it is very much, I talk about how he disbanded most of the religions and he got rid of like the temples, turned into meeting houses, and there's the state buys back all of the farm animals and they have to, people form into these family groups because the larger the family group is, the bigger their communal farm plot is. Just a lot of details like that went into the book from my research that I just really tried to bring alive. I tried to make it my own thing as well, but for sure, it's definitely a lot of research on communism went into this book. Ridiculous amounts of research on communism.
Well, I do find it interesting because, I mean, most typical fantasy worlds you get are usually feudal based or empire based or some sort of like a bonds of fealty and whatnot. It's unusual to see you take something like communism and put that into a fantasy world and to show its dark side and just how bad it could be when it's combined with authoritarianism, totalitarianism. So do you think you're talking about our own world and doing that and the perils of authoritarianism, or is this more a book that you're hoping readers will immerse themselves into these imaginary problems which are based on our own and forget our own real world?
I think it's a little bit of both. I like the fantasy where you can lose yourself in it as a secondary world, which is why I set it in a secondary world. But I also like when there's parallels to our own world, when you can read a book and think about something in your history or in your life a little bit differently. And so I kind of tried to marry the two, and it was a pretty delicate balance to create a secondary world with so many real world aspects. And I really struggled at a lot of the time to really toe that line, to kind of keep one foot in both worlds. I have no idea if I wrote a historical fantasy or not. Some people say I did, some people say I didn't. I don't know. But it's interesting that so far people have been divided on that issue. That's kind of what I was going for, because I really did want to try and strike that balance where if you want to read it to learn things about authoritarianism, then hopefully I gave you something to chew on. But on the other hand, if you didn't, then that's fine too, because it's a secondary world and hopefully you can immerse yourself in it.
Very, very cool. I want to thank you for taking time to tell us about Serafina's Lament. Where can readers find you on the internets?
I am on Twitter as Bookworm Blues, and I am on Facebook. You can look me up as Sarah Chorn. So right now it's there, and bookwormblues.net is my website.
And so by the time this episode drops, Serafina's Lament will be on all general ebook platforms?
I think I'm just going on Amazon for now.
Okay.
If it sells enough and people complain enough, then I'll probably go wide.
Then we'll have to put a link in the show notes to the Amazon page for Serafina's Lament then. So thank you so very much for coming on the show to tell us about your book.
Well, thanks for having me.
And with that, listeners, stay frosty and see you.
If you would like to support this show, you can go to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty or find us on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, our webpage skiffyandfanty.com, or you can even send us an email at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. The intro music for this podcast was taken from Rock Thing by Creo. You can find out more about their music on freemusicarchive.org.